Okay,
I think I'll call the meeting to order for the Housing Finance and Public Health Finance Division.
Okay. Well.
Members, we have first part of our presentation of the Governor's Budget and how it affects this committee today. So we'll be hearing from the Minnesota Housing Finance Agency. I'm going to mention something at the beginning, and then I'll try to mention it again later. You know, the committee has talked about a couple of tours that are available. One of them, I'd like to see, maybe I need to get a few more people here, but we want to do a foreclosure tour, looking at some issues of foreclosure, both in St. Paul and in Minneapolis, and we're working with the Foreclosure Council on that. We don't have dates yet, but I would like to, maybe at the end of the meeting when we have more of our committee here, I'd like to find out a good day for the for committee members to attend for that, to that. Others, I want to encourage you that are to contact Jake if you're interested in going on that A Day in the Life of experience with homeless folks. There are several people who have contacted him, and those arrangements are being made, so I just want to encourage others to do that. And then I think I'll wait, but I do want to remind people about the Housing Legislative Caucus that's been formed and will be meeting next week. So let's start, though, with our Minnesota Housing Finance Agency. We're going to hear about the governor's budget recommendations, and I think we just go ahead and start.
Okay.
Welcome to the committee.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I'm Tanya Orr from the Housing Finance Agency, and with me is Jeanette Blankenship. As I understand it, we have the whole committee time, and so we were.
You do.
Our intention is to do essentially three things. To give you some really high-level overview of how money was spent in the last 2 years, and to provide you with some information about how the state appropriations are spent on a program-by-program or activity-by-activity basis, so that you have an understanding in a sense of what you're buying with the proposed budget. And finally, this might be what everybody wants to jump to, but I think we need to sort of set it up. Finally, we'll talk about specific change items. And those are relatively small in number and I think fairly easy to grasp, but I think it would help to have you understand the sort of context of the entire budget. So we have a PowerPoint presentation without the computer part. we also, I think, have handed out a copy of the performance measures that I wanted you to have as a handy reference, also for you to understand that we do have performance measures that we use on a regular basis. We update on a regular basis. They are part of our management tool. We have another management tool that we use that's the balanced scorecard. And that looks at both from an external perspective and an internal perspective. What are the key things that we need to pay attention to? We update the balanced scorecard on a quarterly basis, and it is a management tool that tells us, are we on track? Do we need to make changes to what we're doing? What's working, what's not? It is something, both the performance measures and the balanced scorecard are things that we think are important to make sure that we're using the money that you make available to us in a wise and efficient manner. So,
so before you get started, the balance scorecard, did you give us a document on that?
I did not give you, Madam Chair, I did not give you a copy of the balance scorecard. I gave you the performance measures.
Is something
that
we could get?
Certainly.
Okay. Thank you.
Page one of the handout is a statement of the mission. We were in to see a legislator last week who said to us, do you have a mission statement? I thought, well, of course we have a mission statement, and we've always had a mission statement. And I was sort of surprised. I assume that most state agencies do. It's, I think, pretty, in some ways, very simple. It's to finance and advance affordable housing opportunities. And we use that word opportunities specifically because there are a couple of different ways that you can provide housing. You can actually help build it or rehab it. But also rental assistance provides people with an opportunity for affordable housing, and that is to something that we do as well. We focus on low and moderate income Minnesotans, and part of our mission statement is to recognize that housing is an important part of the quality of Minnesotans' life and an important part of strengthening community. We have four strategic priorities to finance new affordable housing opportunities, to preserve the existing housing, to end long-term homelessness, and increase the emerging market home ownership. I wanted to give you a sense of some output. For the $114 million that was appropriated in the biennium that's just ending, what did we do with that? We served over 127,000 households. We preserved over 10,000 units of housing. We helped construct over 2,000 new housing units. And we helped over 20,000 households to prevent homelessness and provided home buyer counseling and education to 27,000 homeowners. As you may recall from our presentation last week or the week before, the state resources are a portion of our budget, but not all of our budget. And page 5 of your slides shows you how the resources that are available are broken out. So over half of our resources are bond proceeds. It's a lot of money, but it's also money that can only be used in certain ways. It has to be used in a way that we get revenues back so we can pay bondholders. So it's significantly different in terms of the activities that can be funded than the state appropriation. We also have federal resources, which are primarily Section 8 payments that are passed through to Section 8 home building owners. And we also have some agency resources that are used in ways that are very similar to the state appropriations. Slide 6 gives you an overall picture of the households that we serve. As you can see, well over half of the households have incomes of below $20,000. That is primarily, a lot of that is due to the Section 8 payments that that we pass through to Section 8 building owners. And we have some comparisons of where the households that we serve, their median incomes, compared to some benchmarks like the general assistance payment level, poverty, and 50% of median. One of the things about housing is that it uses different standards than you see, for instance, in the human services world, where you tend to talk about a percentage of poverty. We use a percentage of HUD median incomes as benchmarks most often.
I guess a question, sir. How does that compare? How do the two compare to each other in terms of actual measurements?
I'm going to get my glasses out. Read my chart. We have a poverty level managed here. The poverty threshold for a family of three is $17,170. That was for federal fiscal year 2007. $17,600. Mm-hmm. So you can see that for first-time home buyers, the household income, the median household income, is a little more than double that, the poverty level. I'm just looking for instance, the median income of households served under the rehab loan program is below the poverty level for a household of three. It's around $12,000. Madam Chair, would you like more information?
Well, I guess it's just important to point out that there, in terms of the HUD median, there's no adjustment for the numbers of people in a household. Is that correct?
No, Madam Chair,
it
is adjusted for household size. In a lot of cases, we tend to use the four-person household as the level.
Okay. So it wouldn't matter if there were a different number of people in the household in terms of making the loan or the...
It depends upon the program. Some of the programs have a requirement that the income level be adjusted for family size, and some of the programs don't. In cases where there's not a requirement that it be adjusted for family size, we may use the four-person household as the standard, but then we will adjust upward for larger households.
All right. Thank you.
Page 7 gives you a picture of where our resources are deployed. And the chart provides you with a comparison of what we have calculated is that areas house share of eligible households, and then compares that to the number of households served compared to the statewide total and the share of funds received. We do not say, for instance, the metro area has 60% of the population in the state, and so 60% of the money is going to be spent in the metro area. We don't divide the money up by region. We rely on, for the most part, on applications to be received indicating need, and so it... we don't have any strict formulas. We look at the applications that we have received and award money that way. In most cases, it's fairly close to the eligible share of the population. It's not precise, but it's not wildly off in most years. Yeah. So, do you want me to talk about this? Okay. Jeanette's going to talk about some specific activities that are funded under the state budget.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, for the record, Jeanette Blankenship from Minnesota Housing, and I'm going to give an overview of the five activity areas, as Tanya mentioned, to look at kind of what we're buying with our state appropriation dollars. So this pie chart shows you on slide 9 the percent breakdown of state appropriations and what activity areas they fund. Just so it is a little bit different from what you did the last biennium, in that preservation is increased and development and redevelopment is decreased as a proportion of the total. And we'll talk a little bit more about why that happened.
And this is based on the proposed governor's budget.
Thank you. So for the first activity area, development and redevelopment, we did go over this in our agency overview, so I'll kind of skim these slides that give the overview of the activity area, and we want to provide you with a few examples within each one of the programs. So for development and redevelopment, again, it serves low and moderate income wage earners, and it provides for a variety of areas, including construction, acquisition, rehab, also gap financing, as we talked about yesterday, for example, developments that have tax credits that don't give enough equity financing. The main program here in development and redevelopment is the Challenge Program, which provides these grants and deferred loans for both rental and owner-occupied housing. The Challenge portion of it is really to leverage kind of private and nonprofit dollars that are in the local community. And we have an example of, for example, an employer that gives money because they're expanding the area, there's not enough housing. So part of that challenge is trying to leverage additional private and nonprofit resources in the community. So a single-family example on slide 11 is At Home in Duluth, which is a community-based collaboration, and it's received rehabilitation funds through the Challenge Program since 1999. Since then, they have rehabilitated 354 units in the Duluth area, which totals $4.2 million. Rehabilitation includes electrical, energy efficiency improvements, heating, plumbing. Recently, there was one that the homeowner would have been evicted by code because the home was not habitable, but they were able to rehab the home, get it up to code, and they were able to stay in that home. This program does leverage employer, government, nonprofit contributions from a variety of organizations in the Duluth area. And in this last fall funding round, At Home in Duluth was awarded $432,000, but they leveraged other contributions for a total of $4 million. So this is really kind of the essence of the Challenge Program. A multifamily example from the Challenge Fund, there's a new townhome development in Worthington, and it's a partnership between the city, the largest regional employer, which is J.B. Swift which is expanding the regional agencies and statewide agencies, including Minnesota Housing, as well as BEAD through CDBG and other statewide organizations like the Greater Minnesota Housing Fund. The rental housing demand, as I said, was really high in Worthington because of this expansion, and SWIFT is looking to figure out how can we help work with the community to ensure that we have additional housing opportunities so folks aren't driving 50, 80 miles to work every day. This development, like we said, all of our challenge developments for new construction have green components such as water conserving and Green Star appliances, no VOC paints, and green label floor coverings, which is a standard that they use. The total development cost is for this one, you know, is $4.3 million, and tax credits help cover $2.4 million of that, and we provide some of that gap financing. And again, this SWIFT contributed, I'd say, $50,000 to this, and there's city contribution as well, and a really large partnership to make sure this happens for the community. And they're looking forward to doing more. A recent article in the paper down there says SWIFT thinks this is just one of many that they hope to help get started because they have a growing demand for rental housing for their employees. Excuse me.
I have a question for you, Ms. Langship. In terms of the challenge fund, since the leveraging can come from employers, government, or nonprofit contributions, can you give me, is there a kind of a breakdown that vary a lot? Sometimes it's an employer versus the local government or some other nonprofit.
It really varies. It just depends on the development, the area, the kind of partnership we have going. Sometimes there's just a large nonprofit contribution. Sometimes you have, it's largely the employer in the area, who's ever kind of driving this.
Madam Chair, for instance, in the Rochester area, the Mayo Foundation has contributed to Rochester First Home and other employers in that area, and that's a substantial endeavor. And so that area, they don't focus just on Rochester, but the surrounding area, there has been a lot of employer contribution in that case. In other areas, we would see not very much employer contribution because there aren't large employers. We have seen like a couple hundred dollars from the local hardware store on Main Street. That's really all they can manage. We made a statutory change a couple of years ago so that it wouldn't have to be an employer contribution. It could be a philanthropic contribution that counted towards the leverage. Because, for instance, you might have areas where the employers are so small they can't make much of a contribution. Or, for instance, particularly in the suburbs in the metropolitan area, employers tend to not identify with the city. They identify with the region. And so they're not going to make a contribution to housing in Eagan because they don't identify with Eagan. They identify with the whole Twin Cities. So it really... there are a lot of factors that go into whether the contribution is primarily for some employers or philanthropic organizations or government.
Since the change of statute, has the employer contribution been going downward?
Madam Chair, I believe that it has, but I haven't seen any hard data. We actually sort of expected that given the economy.
Mm-hmm. Move on to slide 13 on the homeowner loans. Again, this funds the Homeownership Assistance Fund, or HAF, and it provides deferred loans for down payment assistance. And although this is a small proportion of the proposed budget, and it usually has been, it allows for recycling. The loan is repaid at 0% interest at the time of the sale of the home that it helped buy when it's resold. And the tightened credit markets really make this program helpful as down payment requirements continue to increase. And it's really a viable, important resource. So we just have a theoretical example on this one. Our median income, like we said, is $45,000. And the median price home for a first-time homebuyer mortgage in our portfolio is about $160,000. With the required minimum 3% down payment currently that most lenders have, plus closing costs, this potential homebuyer would need $7,000 saved. As a single mother with two kids and child care, she has good credit and can afford this $1,200 mortgage, but can't save up that $7,000 to get into that home. The Homeownership Assistance Fund can help with that down payment, allow her to become a homeowner. She gets counseling through that process because we do require pre-purchase counseling with our down payment assistance. and if she's able to afford the home ongoing, and the money does recycle if she sells the home at some point. Next, on the homelessness prevention and supportive housing activity area, slide 15, again, this serves the continuum of at-risk homelessness, homeless and long-term homeless populations, and it provides rental assistance, temporary assistance to resolve a housing emergency, operating subsidies, as well as financial assistance with the capital cost of rental housing. The three state-appropriated programs are Bridges, the Housing Trust Fund, and the Family Homeless Prevention and Assistance Program. A few examples for you, as well as some helpful data. On ending long-term homelessness, this first slide is actually part of our family homeless, it's part of our long-term homeless. And it's just, we have the HMIS system, which captures data. And this is for, first of all, 88% of formerly long-term homeless are still in their housing as of the fiscal year 2008 report at the end of the year. So 52% actually stayed in the housing, and 36% had a positive exit. And a positive exit is getting into perhaps Section 8 or getting into their own housing. It's a negative exit would be eviction or something. So a positive exit is something that they are moving on to stable housing, but they may not be in this long-term homeless supported housing. And then finally, the second bullet is about folks who are in housing at least a year. And we're looking at that second year. You know, what are our outcomes? Are we ensuring that the long-term homeless do, you know, remain in stable housing? Well, after the second year, 75% of households that remained in this long-term supportive housing were still there. And you'll see there's a little bit of difference on the rental assistance and capital sites as far as who stays in, but again, the vast majority are either staying in housing or have a positive exit. And Madam Chair, this is while it's not one of our performance measurements at this point, we're still sort of focused on are we meeting the 4,000 goal. This is really what we want to do. It's not just about building the units. It's making sure that people stay in them, and that's the important part of supportive housing. And I think this demonstrates that we've been incredibly successful so far.
Representative Hayden, did you have a question?
Oh, yeah, thank you, Madam Chair. Can you just tell us the difference between a person that's homeless versus somebody that's been categorized long-term homeless?
Madam Chair, Representative Hayden, the definition definition that the state uses for long-term homeless is someone who has been homeless continuously for more than a year, or I always forget whether it's three times in the last four. It's four times in the last 3 years, I think. You could have multiple episodes of homelessness and be considered homeless, or you could be homeless for a long stretch of time.
Mr. Hayden?
So I would say those that were long-term homeless would be folks that you would probably consider the hardest to serve, because they have continuously have a long history of homelessness, and so other programs haven't worked very well for them. Would that be correct?
Madam Chair, okay. Representative Hayden, that's correct, and that's why all of the literature so far says that in order to successfully house people who have experienced long-term homelessness, we need to have both the housing and the services. So that's why we focus on supportive housing as opposed to just rental, you know, affordable rental housing.
Mm-hmm. Thank you. And next slide 17, has some outcomes as well, an example for our Family Homeless Prevention Assistance Program. This is a really vital program. A lot of it is providing rental subsidies, for example, to families to stabilize them. And last year it served about 8,600 households, or nearly 22,000 individuals. Yeah, and the current biennium, this past 2 years, we focused on veterans and youth. So we've been partnering with veteran organizations like the County Veteran Service Officers and the Minnesota Assistance Council for Veterans, as well as school homeless liaisons, to make sure we're reaching both veterans and youth who are not in stable housing. One example, a woman named Tasha, this past year, in 2007, had three children, and they've been homeless since her husband's death. She had to sell their home to pay for his medical debts that she was still owed on, and ended up in a shelter, the Family Service Center Emergency Shelter. They sent her to Project Homeless Connect in 2008, and she was referred to the YWCA St. Paul's Family Intervention Program. She and the three children moved into stable, subsidized housing because the Family Homeless Prevention Assistance Program provided the down payment or the damage deposit and the first month's rent. So it really got her into housing. She was able to afford it with rental subsidies. She was able to enroll her kids in after-school programming to kind of stabilize them. And she also enrolled herself in the Twin Cities Rise program, which helps with job training. And she's seeking employment currently to make sure that she can get off assistance and provide for her family. Next activity area, the preservation of existing.
Before we move on, I just want to ask you, can you give me the percentage of folks here who are veterans, and are they veterans of recent wars or previous wars?
I don't know if I have that data on me, Madam Chair.
Okay. Maybe you can get it to us.
Yeah.
For the Family Homeless Prevention Program or for the homeless population overall?
I know actually both.
I don't have the number for the overall with me, but I can get that very easily, the Wilder side.
Okay. I know it's been relatively higher, and do you have any up-to-date data on it?
We'll be happy to get you
okay.
The most current data.
Thank you.
Okay. So, Madam Chair, members, for the preservation of existing housing, our next activity area, again, this serves the lowest income households through programs that provide deferred and amortizing loans to rehabilitate homes and rental properties. It's provided through two state-appropriated programs, the Rehabilitation Loan Program and PARIS, or the Affordable Rental Investment Fund for Preservation. In 2008, we made 409 rehab loans to homeowners, and 60% of those were made for energy efficiency repairs. We actually saw an uptick this fall as we had an initiative for additional $10 million in a different fund, as well as 40% made lead hazard repairs. There is some overlap in the 60 and 40, but it shows that this rehab loan program for homeowners is really helping to improve energy efficiency, improve public health by removing lead in homes. An example for one rehabilitation loan that we had in Clay County for a disabled homeowner, his gross income was about $14,000, and he received a rehabilitation loan for nearly $15,000. Again, this is a deferred loan. It increased the home's energy efficiency with new windows, doors, insulation, siding, and it improved accessibility. He did need help with the floors. They were carpet and needed something flat to help with his accessibility. And they added a high-rise toilet, a stand-up shower with grab bars. It really makes a difference in these homeowners' lives. Next, for...
Excuse me, just before you move on.
Yeah, Madam Chair.
You gave some information on the lead cleanup. I don't see it in writing here.
We can't fit everything on your slide.
That's okay.
Madam Chair.
I just want to write it down. I think you said
40% of rehab loans had some component of lead abatement in them. Yeah.
Okay. And was this mostly rental or homeowners?
It's all homeowners.
It's all homeowners.
The rehab loan program.
The rehab loan, okay. And how about the other?
For energy efficiency, 60%. And again, there's some overlap there. It's some component.
Right. And so that's just the rehab loan. And then how about for affordable rental investment? Any lead cleanup with that one?
For Paris, Madam Chair, I don't have...
Madam Chair, we, as we mentioned before the session began, the agency has a policy that any rehab that's conducted with agency funds must address lead issues. So they must meet HUD standards. I don't have with me the percentage of the funds that were used in Paris for lead. I'll see if we have those, but I can assure you that if there were lead issues in any of these are primarily federally subsidized apartment units, if there were lead issues, those were addressed as part of the rehab because they used our money.
And wouldn't it be fair to say a lot of these are high rises and other buildings, not just single?
Madam Chair, for the most part, they are multiple units. Many of them are high rises. Because they're federally subsidized, they may have already addressed the lead issues prior to getting the agency assistance, so the percentage may not be as high as you saw with the rehab loans.
Okay.
But we'll see if we can get that for you.
All right, thank you.
So So, Madam Chair, on slide 20, we have some information about PARIF, which is the Affordable Rental Program for rehab. It invests in aging rental developments that receive federal assistance. So this chart and table show that every preservation dollar spent, so for every dollar we spend on subsidy, we preserve $5.20 of federal assistance. This is very important to protect the federal leverage, to be sure that this program is protected. And, excuse me, there's no date on here, but since 1998, we have to add that. Finally, our last activity area, resident and organizational support. This supports the partner delivery infrastructure that we have, which is necessary to effectively deliver affordable housing here in Minnesota. It provides operating funds for organizations that develop affordable housing. It offers homebuyer training, education, and foreclosure prevention assistance through TCAP, and it coordinates regional planning efforts through our RAG, which we talked about briefly in our agency overview. An example from HECAT, which has been a really important program with the increase in foreclosures and trying to help folks stay in their homes. There's a homeowner in Coon Rapids who fell behind on their fixed-rate mortgage by 4 months, largely due to unanticipated medical expenses, increases in monthly costs, and unforeseen vehicle repair where it completely broke down. They tried to negotiate with their lender, who proposed an infeasible, too aggressive repayment schedule. And so this homeowner sought assistance from the foreclosure prevention counselor at the Anoka Community Action Program, or CAP, as we often hear. The counselor was able to help them apply for a foreclosure prevention assistance program loan, and it brought the mortgage current by helping to bring them up to speed. And you did increase last biennium the amount. It used to be around $5,000, now for the metro area it's around $10,000. And that's really helped homeowners who've been able to access this loan to catch them up. It is a deferred loan, and really help them stay in their homes. So that's a summary of the five activity areas that really show you kind of what we're doing with the money that the state appropriates, and they all serve vital functions in a variety of areas. Tanya's now going to kind of take us through. We did talk on slide 23 about the accountability measures that you have in front of you. So we'll head to slide 24. In
developing our budget, our recommended budget for 2010-2011, we focused on three principles that would help guide our decision making, and many of you have heard this from me already. We decided that we needed to fulfill our commitment under the business plan to end long-term homelessness to increase funding for the Housing Trust Fund. We had, as part of the plan, what money do we need and where are we going to get this money? And one of the things that we said was we wanted the state to increase its funding for the Housing Trust Fund every biennium for, I believe, three bienniums, and this would be the last biennium. So that was one of the things that we felt was important as we crafted the budget. We also felt that it was very important that we preserve the programs that serve the most vulnerable populations. If we're going to have to make cuts, we didn't want to make the cuts on programs that serve the very lowest income and the people that were most at risk. Those programs would be the Family Homeless Prevention Program, the Bridges Program that provides mental assistance for people who have mental health issues, the Housing Trust Fund, and the Foreclosure Prevention Counseling Program. Finally, we wanted to try and preserve as much of the funding for programs that leverage other resources, particularly federal resources. We didn't want to be penny-wise and pound-foolish in cutting a program that brings in federal dollars. So, in particular, the PARIF program, as you just heard, for every state dollar that's spent, we preserve over $5 of federal money. It didn't make sense to us to cut that program in order to help balance the budget, since we would lose federal money for every dollar that we cut. I could argue that every one of our programs leverages some resources, but there are some resources that are really, we know they're going to come in, and so we focused on those programs. So those were the three guiding principles that we used in crafting the budget for the upcoming biennium. The proposed budget funds every program that had been funded in the last biennium. So every activity that we just talked about will be funded in this upcoming biennium under the proposed budget. We were asked to reduce our base budget by 5%. We had in the past biennium, or the biennium that we're just finishing, we had $114 million in state appropriations that were appropriated during the regular session. $90 million of that was base appropriations. So the 5% cut is slightly under $4.5 million. So the changes, the way that we've structured this budget is you look at the last biennium and then you work from there. So we focus on the change items. We are proposing that the 5% cut come from the challenge program. There are two reasons for that, two primary reasons. One is that in this environment, in most markets, there's not an immediate need to add single-family or home ownership new construction units. We have a fairly good supply in most markets, and so we typically spend about $3.5 million biennium. That's the most recent number that we spend on new construction for home ownership units. So if we don't really have a need for that, it seems like that would be an area where we could cut back a little. Now, you know, I want to preface all of this with we're starting with a base. None of us would say that this base met every need, but given what we're starting from, this is the rationale for the decisions that we made. Furthermore, one of the biggest problems that we're facing right now as a state is how do we stabilize the housing market, and particularly in neighborhoods that have suffered a concentration of foreclosures. And that's what we expected that a lot of the challenge fund money would be used for right now, because that's the biggest problem that we're facing. We were fortunate that the federal government appropriated a substantial amount of money for neighborhood stabilization last summer. Minnesota received a total of $58 million. The Housing Finance Agency has $38 million, which we will be awarding at the end of February. And so we have resources to address the foreclosure issue. They are not enough, but by cutting back on the challenge fund, we do have other resources that will help sort of backfill that cut, whereas we have other activities that we didn't have the opportunity for someplace else to backfill a cut. So that was part of the rationale for the cut to the challenge program. The other change items are fairly simple. We, as I said, one of our principles was to live up to the business plan to end long-term homelessness by increasing the housing trust fund by $4 million. For the biennium. Because we were working from a smaller base as opposed to an increased base, we had to reallocate, and we chose to reallocate money from the challenge fund to the housing trust fund so that we could meet what we thought was a real commitment that the state has made to the business plan to end long-term homelessness. And the same rationale that I talked about for the cut to the challenge fund is why we chose to reallocate money from that program as opposed to another program. We are also proposing that we switch funding sources for the two rehab loan programs. We have a homeownership rehab loan program that is currently funded with state appropriations. We have a rental rehab loan program that is funded with federal home dollars. It has become increasingly and painfully clear to us that to use the federal home dollars in rental housing is extremely difficult administratively. There are lots and lots of monitoring and compliance issues that are very easy to get caught up in. We have concluded that if we were going to, on a going forward basis, continue to use home dollars on rental housing, we would have to add staff for monitoring. Most housing finance agencies that administer home dollars use their home dollars on home ownership programs because the administration is much easier. So we are proposing that we do a switch, that we use the federal home dollars for home ownership rehab and we use the state dollars for rental rehab. It will save in terms of staff. And at this point, we think that that's an important thing. It will mean, actually, that there will be more money available for home ownership rehab and less available for rental housing. That is the downside of doing this swap. But if we have to add staff, we're going to take that away from program funding. So we think this is a better way to go. And finally, two more things. Another change is we are proposing that the two Indian housing programs be consolidated with the Challenge Fund, the Tribal Indian and the Urban Indian program, and that money be set aside within the Challenge Fund for Indian housing programs for the first 8 months of every calendar year. We have, and I would be happy to share with you, letters in support of this consolidation from nearly every tribe that's served by these programs. The exception, I believe, is Boys Fort at this point. So this is a consolidation that is supported by the communities that these programs serve. The reason that we're proposing it is sort of twofold. One is from it is really a matter of simplification. The broader the programs and the more flexible programs that we have, the more likely it is that we're going to be able to respond to changing conditions and serve the needs of Minnesotans. We frequently find that a project would be funded under a tribal Indian housing program and there's insufficient funding to complete the project and then they have to apply for Challenge Fund money as well or some other agency resource and then we end up with two loan documents, you know, it gets more complicated. If we had all the money in one program, then we can do one loan document, one application. It's really much simpler. We also, this consolidation, we've been working towards this for a number of years, and we have worked at getting the bands to think about how can you use a variety of agency resources instead of just the one program? And how can you be more efficient and use all the resources available to you in the smartest way possible? So, for example, not in Red Lake, but every place else, the tribes are able to participate in a HUD, what's called HUD 184 program, which is a mortgage insurance program, so that private banks can loan to tribal members on the reservation. Instead of using state appropriations to make that mortgage loan, you can use somebody else's money, and the state appropriations could be used for the down payment assistance, the gap financing. We think that's a smarter way to go, and you can serve more people. Those sorts of opportunities we've been working with the tribes on, and they've been much more open to that, and we've seen a lot more creativity when we started talking about don't just focus on this one program, let's talk about what activities you need to fund and what resources are available to you. So we are now at a point where, as I said, all of the tribes and bands support this consolidation, and so it's included in the budget recommendations. Again, the money that would normally be appropriated for the Indian programs would be set aside specifically for Indian programs for the first 8 months of each year. Finally, this is not a change item because it's a transfer, so it doesn't show up as a change item. But in the special session to address the Southeast Minnesota flood, money was appropriated to the Disaster Relief Contingency Fund. $1 million was appropriated. That's a fund that is really not a program. It is really an account that is made available to the commissioner to respond to presidentially declared natural disasters. And it was established so that there would be money on hand to act really quickly. That fund also is the repository, that account is the repository of repayments of previously appropriated disaster money, that those loans get repaid and they're deposited into that account. We have a situation now where we have seen an increase in the number of children who are staying in shelters. It has been a dramatic increase, particularly in the two center cities. This is not only bad for the kids, it causes a lot of problems for schools. When they have a classroom that is being disrupted by kids moving in and out, it really makes it more difficult to educate all of the children, but particularly the kids that are in a classroom, then out for a week, and then go into a different school because they're homeless. So we think that this is a disaster that we need to address. And we are proposing that money from the Disaster Relief Contingency Fund be transferred to the Housing Trust Fund specifically for the purpose of providing rental assistance for up to 2 years for families with children who are living in a shelter right now. We believe with this $1.5 million, we could serve up to 80 families for a 2 year period. We're hearing from the shelters and the schools that this is really the thing that they need the most, is just some help with their rent until they can get back on their feet. It struck us that while we might have a natural disaster sometime in the future, we've got a crisis now, and we shouldn't have money sitting around when we could use it to help people. And so we are recommending that this transfer occur.
May I have a clarification here? Two things. Did you say $1 million on the document here? It says $1.5 million from disaster relief.
Madam Chair, $1 million was appropriated to the fund, and then we receive repayments as well. And so we have a balance of over $1.5 million, and we're proposing that $1.5 million be transferred.
And correct me if I'm wrong, but wasn't this part of the unallotment, or is that a different part
Madam
of the fund?
Chair, it was part of the unallotment. We had more money. We had more money than this.
How much was unallotted?
I believe that we, I think it was close to $1 million, $1.2 million.
So the governor unallotted 1.2 in addition to this. Is that right?
The governor unallotted 1.2, and we still have a little over $1.5 million left in the fund.
Okay.
Slide 26 is a chart that compares the 08-09 budget to the proposed 10 and 11 budget and indicates where there are changes. As you can see, in terms of the base, for most of the programs, we're not proposing any changes to the base so that we can continue all of these activities that we've been describing. Page 27 is what we hope is a handy little chart that will give you the state appropriations, the proposed appropriations for each state-funded program, and a reference to the budget pages where you can find a further description.
Okay. All right. Well, I'll start with a major question here, or a major concern, I guess, which is, the headline on page 26 says, most housing programs untouched priorities guided decisions. I'm glad about the priorities guided decisions, but it seems like what you're doing is you're accounting for, you're comparing to just the base housing. You're not accounting for the $24.6 million that was added in one-time funding, which was really hard-fought dollars that we put in last time. And so it looks quite different to compare the changes to a budget of $89,916 as a base as compared to the million as compared to the $114.5 million. And the cuts that I would think are real then are quite a bit more. So I'm just wondering, you don't have that part on your chart here, what the cut is to the actual dollars that we had to spend in the last biennium. You're only comparing to the base. Not you've eliminated the hard-fought one-time money as part of the budget that your agency is losing. So, some of us were really hoping, of course, that one-time funding would be permanent funding, and we made some compromises to allow that to happen so we could go forward. But, I think it's some truth in advertising or whatever, we have to really talk about the fact that, you know, that what's available to the agency in some of these areas is a pretty significant cut, even in the areas that you're trying to protect. So, so for example, you mentioned tariff, which looking at your chart here would be the same, but actually there'd be more than a 12% cut based on what, you know, if we're looking at the whole $114 million budget, and there's, you know, certainly larger ones. The challenge fund would be more like a 68% cut. So I just think it's important that we start talking about that too, because if we're going to try to keep your agency doing the good work that it's been doing, we've got to talk about the real budget, not just the base budget. That was the, you know, first thing that we started with.
Madam Chair, I certainly appreciate that, although there's a reason why things are called base and one time only. And we, you know, the instructions are always to work off the base. You know, that, and we are very careful to use one time only money in a way that we don't get caught in a bind of, you know, spending money that has, that the activity has a tail and we don't have the money to fund the tail. You know, this one-time only money is, we've been very fortunate with that, and we really appreciate that we've received over the years significant amounts of one-time only money. Housing is one of the places where it's easier to use one-time only money than it is, for instance, in education or healthcare, and so we recognize that we've benefited from that. But it is money that, by its nature, we need to not be able to count on going forward. And so that is just how the state budgets are constructed, with working from the base.
I guess I'd have to say, you know, the people of Minnesota need us to count on those budgets. You know, they need one-time money is, you know, sometimes an accounting mechanism so we can settle a budget and get a governor to sign a bill. But I just, the need is not diminished by calling it one time. Anyway, I think I made my point. I think it would be helpful to have those numbers, you know, the chart show the numbers that compare it to the actual amount of money that was available to the Housing Finance Agency. So I'm just wondering if you can provide that. If not, we can certainly.
Yes, Madam Chair, we'd be happy to do that.
Other comments? Some numbers? Oh, Representative Stevenson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I apologize for being late here. Just in terms of the February forecast, you know, we're looking at some difficult numbers. Have you had any time to make provision for possible potential future targets that may be available to you? I know that, you know, it could very well be painful. And, you know, as the Chair was talking about, one-time funding is obviously, those are nice to have. And when we had the $2.2 billion budget surplus, housing was a good place to put it because those are some one-time fixes for some much-needed assets. But as we're going into a more constrained budget cycle here, it's going to be a challenge. And so I was just wondering if you have thought about that at all, or is that you don't want to take the hit until you see the fifth coming?
Madam Chair, Representative Stevenson, to a certain extent, I have to admit we've been in denial. We know that it's certainly a possibility, a distinct possibility that the shortfall will be greater than was projected in November. We have a relatively small state appropriation. You know, in the grand scheme of things, you're not going to balance the budget on the Housing Finance Agency appropriation. Between the unallotment and the base reduction, it's the equivalent of an 8 or 9% reduction. So I don't know how much further we can really go. As if we adhere to our principles, there aren't a lot of places, there aren't a lot of programs to go to cut further. And there are other unmet needs. I may be being a little Pollyannish, but there's certainly the possibility that we will get, the state as a whole will receive more federal dollars than are currently budgeted, and in that case, that will help soften whatever additional shortfall we have. Whether it will take care of all of it, I don't know. So we are
since we have developed these principles, we have a decision-making tool in place that if we have to make additional, propose additional cuts, we're prepared to do that, but we're not going to start agonizing over it until we're told to.
Thank you.
Could you talk a little bit more specifically, since you brought it up, what you are maybe anticipating today? It changes daily, I know, but from the federal...
Yeah, Madam Chair,
funding that's being considered right now.
The House, I think, is going to take that up the economic stimulus bill tomorrow. There are a couple of main components in one of the other bills. There's additional money for the Neighborhood Stabilization Program. There's a significant difference in the dollar amount between the House and the Senate. I think the House is at about $4 billion. The Senate is like at $2.5 billion. There is a proposal to have that money be competitive as opposed to distributed on a competitive basis as opposed to a formula basis. It was distributed on a formula basis this last time. So until we see the criteria, we don't know whether we're going to be successfully compete or not. And at this point, we don't know how much the total would be. There is, I think, in both bills, the same amount of money for public housing rehabilitation, preservation. I think it's at $5 billion. I don't expect that would run through the Housing Finance Agency, but public housing is one of the most important parts of our housing stock in terms of providing affordable housing, and to the extent that federal dollars will finally be made available for the much-needed capital repairs in many of our public housing, that will be very important. If we would expect that the state would get a significant amount of money. One of the benefits of that is most of the rehab can be started very quickly because we've already asked public housing authorities to look at that issue about what they need to do in rehab. And there will be things like, for instance, my understanding is the St. Paul PHA needs to replace all the buildings in their senior high-rises, all the windows in their senior high-rises. So that is the potential for real jobs, both in replacing the windows, but also building the windows by Minnesota companies. So that's something that, because it's in both bills, we think it's likely to come to fruition. There is also, I think, about $1 billion roughly in each bill for the HOME program, which is a program that we use, the Housing Finance Agency uses, for down payment assistance and, if this change is approved, for rehabilitation of single-family homes. Though, particularly the rehab of single-family homes is money that could be put to use very quickly. We expect if $1 billion of additional money is appropriated for that program, the Housing Finance Agency would receive about $8 million, which is equivalent to 1 year's of the regular home appropriation for the agency. There is in one bill CDBG money, but not in the other bill, so I don't know where that will come out. The state uses that money is run through local units of government and the Department of Trade and Employment and Economic Development. Is that what it is now? Something like that. And they use a substantial amount of that money for in small communities for rehabilitation of housing. And there is money for some energy components, weatherization, but I don't think that's in both bills. So it is very much up in the air. We'll know, you know, their deadline. They hope that they will get things done by mid-February. And then we'll have a better idea. There's still some details about where this money runs through, whether it's going to be on a competitive basis, are there match requirements. One of the things that the agency is looking at and has set a deadline for ourselves of February 1st is to have a list of projects that would be ready to go in 120 days. That we, a year from now, when you ask us, we will be able to say, yes, those actually were, shovel in the ground, although these will not be new construction, they will be rehab, within 120 days. There's a possibility that there's some money for the state to use. It's not Medicaid money, that's just sort of money for infrastructure. We're going to talk about housing as being an important part of the infrastructure and what we could do to actually get people back to work in 120 days. We're working on that, and hopefully we'll have something by our deadline of February 1st, our self-imposed deadline.
Okay. Since, the calculations that I have here is that the actual cut, if we're looking at the full budget, is about a 25% cut to your funding. 25%. Not 5%. So the one thing I wanted to ask you about is, have you looked at more opportunities to use bonding, the nonprofit bonding authority that we gave you last year, for example? I mean, it seems like one of the ways we might be able to help fill in and, you know, make up for some of the losses. So I'm just wondering if you've thought about that, or if we think about it and figure out a way to try to bring it to you, how would you be able to use that?
Madam Chair, we have had some informal discussions within the agency about additional bonding. One of my original thoughts before the economic stimulus bill was put together was that we could use it very easily on the public housing rehab. There may be less of a need for that if the federal money actually comes through. There are certainly projects that are particularly tax credit projects that we have allocated tax credits for where there is a gap in financing because the tax credits are not bringing as much equity to the table as they used to, that it's possible we could fund with 501c3 bonds if the general partner is a nonprofit. So that is one possible use. I need to say that, of course, these bonds require the state to appropriate the debt service. We don't have that money. If we had that money, then we would spend it. Last year, for the $30 million in nonprofit housing bonds, you needed to appropriate $2.4 million a year for debt service. So that's sort of the ratio. We have not sold any of the 501c3 bonds yet, but we have committed over half of the money, and we have the other half set aside for a very large project. So in our minds, it's basically the $30 million is spoken for. We expect to sell the bonds this spring, and we don't have any concerns about the market because these are appropriations bonds, so they're not in the same market as our municipal bonds. But the key point is there needs to be an appropriation for the debt service. So I'm confident that if money were available, we could put it to good use. It is money you'd have to borrow.
What was the last thing you said?
It's money you'd have to borrow.
Yes, that's right. And we'd have to figure out what the debt service would be. Okay. One of the things I know we had talked about, I believe it was in the bonding bill, the possibility of doing some housing land trust that could be publicly owned, that could be a source of funding. And I think that's one of the things that you folks are looking at too.
Madam Chair,
I wonder if you can update us on whatever you have figured out with that, because I think it was a request in the bonding bill that you tell us how you might use that if we could get you those kind of bonds.
Madam Chair, the Housing Finance Agency, I think, is one of the largest funders of land trusts, both in terms of providing funding for the acquisition of the land and then providing the first mortgages for the family to purchase the home. We could use 501c3 bonds for the purchase of the land as long as the land is owned by a nonprofit. We don't have any, as I said, we've been one of the largest funders of land trusts over the years. Land trusts are certainly one of the tools to make affordable housing available.
Do people need to know a little bit more about land trusts? Do they want to just hear a little more? I know we have some new committee members. Can you just run through briefly just how that would work?
In basic terms, it takes different forms in different communities, but generally money is made available to a nonprofit, to a community land trust group, And that nonprofit acquires the land and the building. And in Minneapolis and in other areas, it's scattered sites, so it's not a tract of land. It's like one home here and another home someplace else. The land trust then holds the land, sells the building to a qualified home buyer. Usually there are, in almost all cases, there are restrictions on resale, so that the home buyer, when they go to sell the property, they're only selling the building, they're not selling the land. The land is still held in trust by the community land trust. The, usually there is a restriction on the amount of profit they can make from the sale of the building. So it may be limited to a certain percentage, it may be limited to a dollar amount, it may vary with how long that they hold the land, the property. Those are terms that the land trust establishes on their own. The idea, the concept is that twofold. One is by taking the land out of the equation, you keep the cost down on a permanent basis. So and in single family, the old rule of thumb was that in a single family home, land is about 25% of the cost. So you take that out of the equation, so you reduce the cost of the home significantly to the home buyer. And then the other part of the concept is that by having resale restrictions, you also continue the affordability, so that people are potentially giving up some of the equity. Sometimes there's not a resale restriction. You can sell the property for whatever, the building for whatever you can sell it for, but then you have to share in the equity with the land trust, and then the land trust can use that money to acquire another property. So there are varying ways to, but that general concept is that you're providing a very long-term, if not perpetual, affordability.
We're going through that. One of the things that when we look at our foreclosure issues, this came up, this idea came up more, I think, last year, but the, actually one of my Republican colleagues had brought it up, and I thought it was a very good idea too, which was to talk about, you know, maybe looking at some of our foreclosed properties in areas where we have such concentrations. We have whole neighborhood areas, you know, just devastated, and there may be a way to apply the land trust option there. And I'm just wondering if that makes sense to you, if you've done any thinking about that, maybe one of the things that we could bring forward to the agency.
Madam Chair, with the Neighborhood Stabilization Program funds, there is a providing money for land trust is an eligible activity, and as we testified earlier, we have only made really one restriction on the types of activities that could be funded with the NST money. So I understand that some communities are looking at land trust as a way of providing some long-term affordability.
Okay. Anybody else have comments or questions? Okay. Well, I want to thank you for your presentation today. Just again, maybe to remind committee members, we are still arranging for the opportunity for tour of some foreclosures, probably in two areas, perhaps in St. Paul and possibly in Minneapolis, for sure in St. Paul, I think. There's also the opportunity for any of those folks who want to participate in day in the life, chance to go to spend some time with homelessness folks. And I wanted to remind people also that we are going to be next Wednesday, 11:30, you're all invited. Representative McNamara, myself, Representative Spencer, really anybody who wants to, but we're the ones who are working on this, Representative Lane, who are working on this for a few months to try to get a bipartisan, bicameral legislative housing caucus going here in the legislature so that housing gets more attention at the in the budget, and we hopefully will have a better target eventually. So that's going to be next Wednesday, 11:30. The pizza will be served and perhaps something to drink with that. And it'll be over at 181. It'll just be an hour. 118 of the state capitol. And the idea is basically to talk about kind of how we can work together in those ways. The Senate, for some of you who may not be familiar, part of the outcome of Senator B. Moore and myself having convened the beginnings of this with some of y'all and with working with a lot of the advocates in this area, The Senate now does have they added housing to one of their major committees. It's now the Economic Development and Housing Committee. And they also have created a subcommittee between the policy committee that deals with housing and the finance committee, Representative Tomasoni's committee, and Senator Mark and Senator Tomasoni's committee. So it puts us in a little better shape in terms of dealing with some of these issues when we get to conference committees and otherwise. So I just wanted to mention that to you all, and let's see. Anything else? Oh, the minutes? Yeah, we have to prove the minutes. Thank you. Representative Lane, did you get a chance to look at these minutes? Okay. Representative Lane moves the approval of the minutes for January 27th, 2009. Any discussion on those minutes? If not, all those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Opposed, no. Motion prevails, and the minutes are adopted.
Anything else?
Okay. The meeting will be adjourned. Thank you.